My name is Mike Corris. I'm one of the co-founders of Sample 6. And Sample 6 is a startup community company here in Boston. We are developing novel diagnostic tools for the food safety industry in order to detect pathogenic bacteria like E. coli, Salmonella, Listeria much more rapidly than before, which then will lead to even safer products.
So you're hanging out in the lab looking at some great results. Or maybe you're looking at some not so great results. But in either case, you're suddenly inspired and think, hey, this would make an excellent basis for a company. You start thinking a little more and you realize, actually, I have no idea what it takes to turn this into a company. Well, what better person to learn about the startup process from than someone who recently got through it successfully? Michael Corris, along with Professor Timothy Liu from MIT, co-founded Sample 6, a biotech startup based in Cambridge, Massachusetts, that focuses on using phage to detect pathogens in food products. Dr. Corris earned his PhD from Boston University in Professor James Collins' lab, and later worked as an entrepreneurial fellow at Flagship Ventures. Dr. Corris hopes to enable those in the biotech startup field by providing advice and mentorship to young entrepreneurs. Toward this end, Dr. Corris recently founded the nonprofit, biotechstart.org, and became a member of Agene's board of directors. We sat down with Dr. Corris to pick his brain on the startup process and for some insight on getting into biotech. Okay, great. You're based in Boston. How did you get your start in the Boston community? And what bought you, did your grad work at Boston University in the Collins Lab, and what kind of got you there?
Yeah, so I got introduced to Jim Collins via a phone call when I was looking around for grad labs and emailing various different professors about their research, trying to set up interviews and discuss with them the way they conduct their research and what they're really passionate about, because for grad work, it's extraordinarily important to find somebody who is a good fit in terms of passion for you and also as good a fit as you can make it in terms of management style and the way in which they conduct research and discovery. And I was going through my interviews, and eventually there's just a number that popped up on my phone that I didn't recognize. And I picked up, and it was Jim. And we had a quick conversation. He invited me over to his office. And it was one of those transformational discussions that I had with him, which is not super long, maybe half an hour, 45 minutes. But within that short window of time, you get a glimpse into what his particular way of doing engineering and doing discovery and science and research is. And I found that extraordinarily fascinating. And I just knew that I want to be a part of that.
And what was that particular way? What was the most interesting thing?
Yeah,
about
so he is a very exponentially focused guy. He likes exponential discovery, exponential research, something that accelerates future research and advances our knowledge in a step function, essentially, something that radically improves our understanding now from where it was before. And that makes it more challenging. Certainly, from a research perspective, it certainly challenges every grad student and postdoc that's in his lab to come up with a better and better hypothesis and more interesting way to discover novel biological pathways or figure out novel ways to utilize these biological systems from an engineering point of view. But then he actually also takes a hands-off approach because he's not a micromanager. Mm-hmm. He challenges you to self-organize with your fellow grad students and get the resources you need. He's very supportive, mm-hmm. so he's not stingy, certainly. But he also says that the idea has to stand the test of peers. So it has to be good enough and interesting enough to, you know, survive lab meetings. And mm-hmm. everybody is not in a negative way at all. Looking at an idea, okay, is this really up to the standard? Is that really what we want to be doing with our time? Because everybody's investing time, even when they're reviewing your ideas or you're thinking about your data. They're certainly sitting through lab meetings at 3 p.m. on a Friday when they either could be working or going home, like me working. And that's got to be good enough. So it's a high standard of scientific excellence that's got to be pursued. And his focus, and this is why I also gravitated towards his lab in bioengineering, was applications focused. Like, what is the result of this research? It's not just discovery. It's got to be an application at some point in time, mm-hmm. sooner, better than later. Because we do want to make the world a better place, for lack of a better terminology. And our field of improvement is biomedicine. Mm-hmm. So it should be clinically focused or veterinary focused or consumer focused.
And so what was the particular application that you worked on in Jim's lab?
So I was looking at bacterial resistance pathways and the ways in which they become either permanently or transiently resistant or to antibiotics, which for bacteria is a huge advantage evolutionarily because many bacteria fight each other by producing various different kinds of antibiotics. But we as a species, as humans, have developed and leveraged these particular kinds of antibiotics to rid ourselves of bacterial infections. And that's really powerful since the 1930s and 40s. And because we're so successful, unfortunately, these bacteria have now evolved, many bacteria have evolved resistance against particular classes of antibiotics. And nobody wants to go back to the pre-antibiotic area where you would die if you get a cut on your finger. Mm-hmm. And that's really truly terrible and terrifying. So we wanted to understand the ways in which bacteria have evolved complex resistance mechanisms and ways to become more resistant quicker rather than more slowly in order to combat that more effectively. Mm-hmm. And that's a combination of using a systems biology approach to understand the extremely complex biological systems, and then using a synthetic biology approach to affect these systems. Mm-hmm.
And so the end product from that was then, from your grad work anyway, trying to develop phage as a way to combat resistant bacteria?
Yeah, so phages were a side project mm-hmm. at that particular time because I was still focused mostly on understanding the intracellular resistance pathways and the response networks that bacteria have and utilize when there's this adverse negative stimulus of an antibiotic that's put onto the population. But from that, we found that, okay, there's certain different nodes that you could target within these response networks in order to make the populations more vulnerable to antibiotic stimuli. So that's when you then start to say, okay, well, which ways can we target these nodes by? And bacteriophages actually ended up being a very powerful way of doing so because they have a very highly specific way of targeting bacteria. Mm-hmm. And bacteria only, so they're nicely selective in that one, which is always important for any antibiotic agent that you're developing. It's got to be pretty selective, so no off-target effects, hopefully no effects on the human host and so on. And then you also got to be able to work with the particular agent that you've chosen. For small molecules, certainly you can use a lot of chemistry. When you're working with bacteriophages, you got to use molecular biology and synthetic biology to refactor the genome and piece it back together in a way that's useful to you. And bacteriophages are pretty much the upper limit mm-hmm. on what we can do from a synthetic biology point of view. Mm-hmm. To refactor anything, certainly there have been great efforts to put together a synthetic yeast chromosome. Jeff Buca, for example, of NYU does that. And Craig Venter and Synthetic Genomics and the JCVI have built a synthetic version of a small microbial genome. Mm-hmm. But those are one-off efforts. That's not something that routinely sure. happens.
Yeah, so phage is much more approachable. As
it is for grad students, yeah. at least. So yeah. you got to recognize who you are. You're a 20-something grad student in the lab. You don't have that much experience. You certainly don't have all the resources in the world. So you got to pick something that you can actually have some sort of traction with. Otherwise, it's pretty frustrating.
And so you thought essentially that phage was working so well in your lab work that it could potentially spin off into a startup company. And so kind of how did you get that idea in your head and what happened with the company?
Yeah, that's an interesting short story. So we didn't think that phages were already so super advanced and successful that we could just go out and spin it out. Uh-huh. We thought it was interesting enough proof of concept. So this was my initial introduction, I think, to good enough mm-hmm. and interesting enough. So minimum data set with maximum value, because we certainly couldn't generate a very comprehensive data set, not as grad students. And I say we because it was Tim Liu and myself who were the co-founders of Sample 6. And we were grad students together in Jim Collins' lab at the same time. As so often happens, you work together on a bench and you start talking and eventually you discover that you have a similar shared passion for positively affecting clinical progress or human progress. And we decided to take part of this research and spin it out into a company called Novophage Therapeutics. It was back then a therapeutics company. It eventually became a diagnostics company and we renamed it Sample 6 because you sample and you get your results in 6 hours. But back then it wasn't because we wanted to try to bring a novel antibiotic solution into the market. And that was in 2009. So that's right around the time the world almost ended from a financial point of view. Certainly for certain large investment banks, it did. And we couldn't get any kind of funding for it. So we won a few business plan competitions. That was cool. We got some money for it, but nothing that you could use to finance a biotechnology startup, because that's not nearly as cheap as a web startup or an IT startup of any sort. You need labs, you need consumables, and so on. Manipulating physical matter is very time-consuming and expensive. Unfortunately, I wish it was as easy as writing code. It's not yet. So we put a pin in it after we couldn't get money for it. That was in mid-2009 when we graduated. And I joined Flagship Ventures as an associate, a local Cambridge venture capital firm, very prominent in biotechnology, which was very interesting to me because I got to learn how biotechnology startups are created, how they are funded, what they need to look like in order to be successful. So taking those learnings and still working on the idea of NovoPhage / Sample 6 on nights and weekends together with Tim, who is much smarter than me and had started his professorship at MIT, we eventually came to the conclusion that we could use the same technology base but apply it to a diagnostics aspect. And using that particular transformation of our idea, we were able to raise funding. And all total, I think 5 years ago we started in 2010, all total we raised about $25 million and we're now about 30 people, not far from the Agene headquarters actually in Cambridge, like every other biotechnology startup. And we're live and kicking. We have a product in the market. We're approaching seven-figure revenue, and that's amazing for something that started on the bench. Just a few years ago. It feels longer, but it really wasn't that long. I certainly look at pictures of myself from back then, and it does look like it was a lot longer ago than it was.
To recap, as part of its successful growth, Dr. Corse's company, NovoPhage, evolved into Sample 6. During this transformation, the company changed its focus from the development of phage-based therapeutics to the development of phage-based tests for bacterial pathogens in food products. As Dr. Corse explains, the reason for this switch was largely that it's easier to deal with regulations surrounding the development of tests for food products than those surrounding the development of therapeutics.
What made it kind of easier for you to develop a phage diagnostic in food safety as opposed to a therapeutic?
It's a very interesting way that the FDA looks at the food space as opposed to the clinical space. They're both regulated by the FDA, but in the clinical space, generally, because of the application of anything into a human, you have to go through a necessary initial safety testing, and then efficacy testing, because you don't just want anything to be approved. In the food space, it's different because we've been eating food since the dawn of time, and we know that that's generally safe. So essentially what the FDA now focuses on is keeping the food clean. That means can't have any weird adulterants in there. Their terminology for bad stuff is an adulterant.
Okay.
If you have something like melamine in your milk, the milk is adulterated. And it's actually...
What is melamine?
Melamine is a chemical. So the melamine scandal / crisis was milk and milk products that were produced in China that were contaminated with melamine. It's a chemical maybe 5 or 6 years ago. And that created a whole bunch of issues for people, health issues, and I forget, but some people might have actually died, which is generally not something you expect from eating food. And you shouldn't. It's unacceptable. So the FDA mandates that you can't have any adulterants in there, and they include certain allergens, it includes certain toxins, includes certain chemicals, and includes certain microbes. Not all microbes, by the way. Most microbes are exceptionally good for you, and the vast majority of the microbes live in harmony with us, on us, in us, and so on.
You need a hearty microbiome,
and you need many, many, many. You have many distinct microbiomes on you and in you, and that is good because we, as a holobiont, exist in symbiosis with these guys as we now learn more and more, which is really exciting from a scientific point of view. So you want to be targeted about what you do. You don't want to be nuking your microbiome by taking excess antibiotics. You don't want to be keeping your food sterile because that's also not helpful. But you do want to keep those pathogens out of the food because they can and do harm you. And pathogens like E. coli that was responsible for the jack-in-the-box outbreaks in the early 90s really put a focus on pathogenic microbe control on the FDA's map. People died from eating a burger. That's terrible. Having said that, they certainly died from eating a burger before as well. The difference is, in the early 90s, the FDA and the CDC and other agencies had the tools to figure out what actually was happening. So they started to understand what the problem was to a degree that they didn't before. And they took action, which is good. They mandated can't have E. coli, not even a single cell, in your ground beef and in certain other foods. Can't have Listeria, which is another bad bug. Can't have Salmonella.
Mm-hmm.
So keep it clean, which is good, of those particular pathogens.
So how were people testing for that before?
Classical microbiology.
Okay.
And what you do is you take a sample. Either you take a swab sample by rubbing something that is similar to a dish sponge on a stick over a surface. Either your boot surface or a conveyor belt or the inside of a shipping crate, stuff like that. Or you take the actual food stuff, a sample, a grab sample, 25 grams, it's about an ounce and change, or more of the food stuff. And then you got to grow the particular pathogen that you have that you want to assess if it's present or not in your food within that sample. And then you run more traditional molecular biology methods on it, like PCR, for example. And that process takes anywhere between like 24 to 72 hours.
And is that done on site usually? Like you actually
grow? It depends, actually. So some very large organizations can actually and do it on site. For them, the benefit of doing the on-site testing and getting the result faster is worth staffing and operating a lab and having qualified and highly qualified molecular biologists and microbiologists working with them. Most everybody else, when you get to smaller producers, send it to a third-party lab, mm-hmm. accredited, ISO-accredited third-party lab, and that then runs the test for them. So you incur shipping costs and shipping time as well.
Mm.
What we have done by leveraging bacteriophages and the evolutionarily beneficial specificity that they had to evolve, we actually don't have to enrich anymore. You don't have to wait for that. You don't run the risk of growing pathogens in your site, on your site, so you can actually run the same test as you would in a microbiology lab after 2 or 3 days of processing in-site, on-site within the same shift, so about 6 hours
mm-hmm.
From sample to result, and that's why we're called sample six.
Mm, okay. I was actually going to ask you that.
Yeah, there you go. It's we thought long and hard about it, and we had lots of very scientifically sounding names, but we decided, look, let's just be simple, mm-hmm. and that's what it does. And that was helpful. So
and so is that because you're working with in order to make it so you can detect things in the first place, are you working with a particular luciferase or something like that?
So actually the way we detect the bugs is by making the bugs emit light.
Mm-hmm.
We turn them into mini fireflies, mm-hmm. essentially. So it's an enzyme that is very closely related, but not the same as the firefly tail glow enzyme. So you provide it with a chemical substrate, some sort of feeding reagent, if you will, and the enzyme cracks the reagent, and by doing so, it releases photons.
Mm-hmm.
So what our detection system does, it just detects photons. And that can be very sensitive because the presence and absence of photons can be highly sensitively detected in these background samples, which usually have zero
mm-hmm.
photons. So that's kind of nice.
Awesome. And so the first pathogen that you guys are detecting is Listeria, correct?
That is true.
And so why did you start with Listeria?
Listeria is a pretty bad bug. E. coli is bad too. It'll go after your kidneys. And Salmonella is bad too. It'll go after your gut and you get gastroenteritis. But Listeria might kill you. And the mortality that you get from Listeria is anywhere between 25 to 50% if you get infected with it. And it tends to be more antibiotic resistant than not,
mm-hmm.
than these other bugs. It's actually also worse when you're infected with it, which contributes to its mortality rate. So we found we would have, from our point of view, the greatest impact on this particular pathogen. So we go after the worst one
mm-hmm.
early on. And yes, the market tests for other things. So we will be developing tests for Salmonella. That's going to be the next one. And then for E. coli, it's going to be rounding out the portfolio. But Listeria is a bad one.
Mm-hmm.
If you get it, it goes after expectant mothers, it goes after immune-compromised populations, it goes after the weak and the elderly. Anybody that has a weakened immune system,
mm-hmm.
certainly, but then it kills them, and that's really horrible,
yeah.
from eating food, for example.
So that's interesting. So it wasn't like a practical reason, like it was easier to detect or something
it's
like that.
It's actually not easier to detect.
Well,
over the past 4.5 years, I should say, that we've done this, we've asked ourselves many times, why did we start with Listeria?
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't we do something easier like Salmonella or E. coli?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's another lesson from startup land. You pick, and then you got to go at it pretty hard. You can't keep moving your target because then you won't make enough progress towards any one target. You will essentially exhaust your time and your capital and your energy by going after a changing target, as opposed to, okay, we made that first bet. We made it for good reasons. So trust the reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure that they're good reasons, but then trust them and go at it.
Sure, yeah. And so who's using Simple Six's technology right now?
So some of the customers that we can name, because they have agreed to be named publicly, is a deli company, Dietz & Watson. Okay. They're actually based in Philadelphia. You might see them. They're like...
I think I've had their ham or something.
Yeah, I'm sure you have. They're pretty popular
in
the Northeast. And they're using Simple Six to control their environment and to make sure that Listeria is not present.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a problem when you are consuming ready-to-eat foods, be it a salad kit or be it a deli ham or cheese or other things like that, because you're not cooking them.
Mm-hmm.
Technically speaking, if you would cook all your food through all the way, like really nuke it, it would be safe from a microbial point of view, which is one of the big reasons that foods get cooked or preserved or pickled or salted or fried. Makes it safe.
Yeah.
And the frying at least makes it delicious. So the changing nature of our understanding of nutrition, though, guides us towards less processed foods, number one, certainly more vegetables. And the changing nature of society leads us to more ready-to-eat foods like salad kits. Like, I have not bought a head of lettuce in a long while and chopped it up myself and whatnot.
Yeah.
For convenience. I'm stressed, I'm tired, and I'm lazy. So in doing so, I rely more on the processors to be safer than they were before in order to protect me, because my behavior has changed. And they certainly charge me a premium for this kind of salad. So both have to go hand in hand. The processor has to be safer. They can charge me a premium. That's cool. That's why I'm buying it.
Yeah.
But it has to be materially safer than that head of lettuce, which itself is safer if you remove the outer leaves and so on.
Mm. So are these particular companies like mandated to be doing this type of testing, or is it just because, like you said, it's kind of a premium for the buyers to see that they're doing this kind of testing?
Yeah, so I don't want to misrepresent that. It's not that they are claiming that they're safer than others. Food safety in general is a non-competitive issue for the industry. Everybody tries to be as safe as they can. Everybody can always be safer, no doubt about it.
Yeah.
And the point of the matter is that some people have started working with us as opposed to other testing companies, so they will be safer now. And the other point is that the FDA does not mandate a certain level of testing up to now. So the big piece of legislation that has been finally written into law and published in the Code of Federal Register is the Food Safety Modernization Act, or FSMA, as we would pronounce it. That piece of legislation was passed in 2011, eventually worked its way through Congress and various different approvals and reviews, and is now part of the law, and that mandates an increased frequency of testing for everyone.
Okay.
And there's various different compliance guidelines that larger, smaller, and medium-sized producers have to comply with.
So that's perfect for Simple Six, I guess.
It is a very beneficial macro trend, I'm not going to lie. Yeah. It actually also helped precipitate our decision to move into food safety.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it took us about 4 years to develop a robust test, and it took the legislation about 4 years to work its way through the system.
I'm sorry.
So it's actually dovetailing nicely, and we've seen the beneficial effects of this particular legislation and the awareness that comes along with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that the FDA all of a sudden goes and inspects every facility in North America. That's
illusory,
because food is an enormously large industry. Everybody eats three times a day, usually, if we think that, let's say, Canada and the U.S., there's about 350 million people.
Mm-hmm.
That's about a billion meals a day, every day, and more on Thanksgiving, of course. So what we have here is a very large system that has an extremely high production throughput. And the FDA is incapable, any organization in the world is incapable of surveilling that system. So you need to trust that the system is aware and that the participants are good actors and they are willing to invest in safety. And we've seen that so far.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to make food more safe. Nobody wants to produce unsafe food, which is clear.
Yeah.
But there are real pressures. Food is actually very cheap
in
the U.S., certainly, and in this millennium more so than the previous millennia. So you got to recognize that they have a certain margin to work with. So everything has to work together, and we have to provide the right performance at the right price point, so we can charge what a clinical diagnostic test would charge.
Sure.
It's not the same.
Yeah.
So conveniently, we did work everything out, and we are capable of being a successful business, luckily. Otherwise, we produce a very good test, and in an unsustainable way, which is unfortunate.
It's interesting that you've been able to come from being a grad student into starting your own company. And I guess what do you like about those two roles, and what's kind of the same about those two roles, and what's different about those two roles? So being a researcher versus being, I'm guessing you've moved more into a managerial position now. What do you like about those two things, and what do you dislike about them?
Yeah, it's a great compare and contrast study, I guess. The world of the grad student is very similar in some aspects and then vastly dissimilar in most other aspects from anything else, really, but also especially startup culture and startup world. As a grad student, I think you have freedom, fundamentally. You have the freedom to do pretty much whatever you want on your own schedule. Cynical and sarcastic minds would say that because nobody cares about your research, which partially is true, but it's your job as a grad student to make them care.
Yeah, you have to care about it.
You have to care about it, and you have to make it interesting enough.
Sure.
And that actually is very similar
on
the entrepreneurial side. You have to have people be interested. It's not obvious usually from the beginning of any venture that it's better than anything else. And usually you're met with a lot of skepticism, and you hear a lot of no. This is not useful. This is not meaningful. This is a bad use of resources. That's actually pretty similar to being a grad student. Like, this research is incremental. It's boring. Nobody cares.
Yeah.
So you got to make somebody care. And I think that's the same thing. So you got to communicate. You got to tell your story. You got to be incredibly rigorous as a grad student and as an entrepreneur. And this is where the two worlds diverge more strongly, because you have much more time as a grad student. You're fundamentally not time limited, unless all of a sudden you find that the $1,000 that your PI had for you is gone and whatever, and your PI will not find more money for you. You're out of time and out of money. But by and large, if you're in a reasonably well-funded lab, and granted, we're incredibly fortunate here in Boston that there's many, many, many well-funded labs, and there's an enormous amount of NIH money and other agency kind of monies and foundation money that we get. If you're in that scenario, you're not time limited. You can do whatever you want at whatever pace for however long you want, unless your PI kicks you out eventually.
Sure.
In the startup world, it's not like that.
Mm-hmm.
In the startup world, perfect or very good is the enemy of good and or good enough. And because you have a very finite amount of money, even if you apply to funding agencies. Because all of a sudden, conducting biomedical research yourself is a very expensive value proposition. Everything costs a lot of money, and things still take long, even if you try to move maximally quickly. So learning to differentiate between a nice-to-have versus a must-have piece of data or experiment is critical, and took me a little while. It took everybody a good long while.
So a lot of time management stuff.
Time management, but also really prioritizing, and then mostly just cutting. And nope, we're not going to do this. No, we're not going to do that. What's the minimum data set that we can generate with this amount of money and that amount of time that will give us maximum value?
Sure.
That's really the fundamental difference, I think, between startup science and grad student science. And of course, what you also have to do in startup land is you're responsible for everything. So you're responsible for IT support, janitorial services, fundraising, managing, recruiting people, running the lab, planning experiments, doing data analysis, doing experiments. Every once in a while, I still get in the lab, but very infrequently. It's exhilarating and challenging at the same time, because you're doing so much at the same time. And then you also get crushing responsibility. As soon as people say, like, oh, we believe that this is exciting, all of a sudden it flips and you have people working with you and for you that you're responsible for.
Yeah.
That in some instances, more instances than not, they quit their jobs and work with you. So you're entering into a social contract. You are supposed to provide them with money that they can live.
Yeah.
And you need to make sure that that is actually true. So you can't just frivolously say, like, oh, we're all going to be rich and everything's going to be peachy. You got to be scrupulous about that.
Yeah. And so kind of along those lines, I've heard you say in other interviews that you kind of have to be able to be willing to take abandon all safety nets when you've started a startup and take on a ton of risk. So I guess for you, what did that mean for you personally in terms of, like, what were you risking? What could have happened if things failed?
That's a very good point. I also got to now go back into the internet and figure out, like, what all my interviews are, so I don't contradict myself. Or maybe that's a good thing. But the interesting point is that you have to take risk. Otherwise, there's very little reward to be had. But it shouldn't be an uncalculated risk. It should be a reasonably well-defined and also bounded risk. So defined, I want to use in this context as saying it has this kind of potential outcome for me. It could be total failure or vast success. What happens if it's a total failure? Am I going to be financially bankrupt? Am I going to be physically debilitated? Mm-hmm. And so on and so forth. And then it's got to be bounded in time as well. You can't infinitely take on that risk. You got to say, in an if-then scenario, if I don't succeed for whatever initial milestone I set myself within 12 months, then what? Mm-hmm. Do I actually keep going or do I not keep going? So mm-hmm. I think this is where...
And it's critically important that decide that before you go
yes,
into it.
Yes, absolutely. Right? Yeah. Sorry, absolutely. You got to decide it before you go into it, because once you go into it, the psychological burden of having committed to this path of action is very high, actually, and it starts to skew your decision-making very strongly. Mm-hmm. And even though you're cognizant of the bias, it's hard to get around it. Mm-hmm. So having that set of criteria mapped out before is extraordinarily important and very helpful. And conveniently, I was already married by that time. I discussed this with my wife, mm-hmm. and we decided that it's got to be bounded 12 months, and we got to raise the Series A, which has to be a minimum of $2 million within 12 months, because I quit my job at Flagship Ventures mm-hmm. as an associate, you know, reasonably well paid,
yeah,
and quit it, and then decided to go in with Sample 6, which was awesome, mm-hmm. best thing ever. Having said that, if we weren't able to raise at least $2 million within 12 months, we would have been out of cash. Mm-hmm. And living off of savings, certainly, mm-hmm. But also not able to do anything else. So, and that means that within these 12 months, the money has to come from somewhere.
Sure, yeah.
And if you actually can't even think through a couple of different scenarios that you can potentially get to this money, let's say grant funding, let's say venture capital funding, let's say, well, Kickstarter wasn't that big back then, but Kickstarter or some other way of funding, or you have a rich uncle, mm-hmm. for whatever reason, right? Like, the money's got to come from somewhere. If you can't even think that through reasonably, then that's a hard nut to crack. To even go into it. But if you can and have a couple of different ways, like I could do it this way, I could do it that way, or maybe I get some money from here, I get some money from there, then I can make it work. Okay. That starts to be reasonable just on the funding side. There's plenty of other stuff, product map product market fit and team and all these other things, technological mm-hmm. challenges that go into it. But even just on the money side, because without money, you can't do anything. That's the fuel mm-hmm. that really drives everything forward.
Yeah. Okay. So, kind of along those lines as well, in terms of taking the risk to do sample six, you had to abandon your original idea of working on something that would be medically well, mm-hmm. you're still medically relevant, but you're not a direct treatment.
Absolutely.
Part of the reason for that seems to be largely practical, just because you wouldn't be able to get funding for it, mm-hmm. And there are a lot of regulatory barriers. So my question is, and you kind of touched on this earlier, is whose responsibility is it then to go into those areas where there's a lot of risk and it's very difficult to break through the barriers that are preventing you from making a product, and it's hard to get investment in that product, but that you still think would be a very useful idea?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. You're talking about responsibility, I guess, from a socioeconomic perspective.
Sure, yeah.
It's everyone's responsibility, but because one of the primary ways of instantiating innovation in the US, at least, is through startups or commercial enterprises, it has to be economically interesting. Mm-hmm. So by and large, you can't force it to happen without strongly incentivizing it from the governmental side. And a little bit of that has happened now. There is something called the 21st Century Cures Act, and mm-hmm. then before that, the GAIN Act. I forget what it stands for, but it's something like Get New Antibiotics Approved or something. So pretty cool. So the Congress and recognized that antibiotics development was not appropriately incentivized, and they did something about it, which was great. Bipartisan effort, very good. But also with that, the commercial landscape has to change, which means that larger players have to recognize that antibiotics development is important, and they now have. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it is a timing thing, which means that, you know, 5-6 years ago, nobody was ready to do this.
Yeah.
And now, 5-6 years later, some people are. So if I were at the stage where I was 5-6 years ago now, I would maybe get funding for a therapeutic company. And I hope that somebody is thinking about using bacteriophages mm-hmm. in the particular way that we thought about for antimicrobial applications.
Yeah. And again, along those lines, so in because you were able to transition to something that worked, I guess, was that personally difficult for you because your original goal was not to do that? Being an entrepreneur, is it more important for you to be able to just get something cool out there that's going to end up selling in the end? Or is it more important to really have a good idea, a good particular idea?
That's an interesting question. So maybe and multi-layered. So maybe the most accessible layer first, which is a difficult personally. Yeah, it is.
Mm-hmm.
You've already invested years of research and likely, and in our case, at least a year and a half worth of effort trying to raise funding for this particular idea. And this is the psychological bias that I'm talking about. You've invested so much of yourself and other resources into it that you believe that it should be valuable and it should be recognized by everybody else as being equally valuable or more, as you believe it. But the thing that I learned is most everybody does not care as much about the thing that you're working on as you do.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty much true for anything as a grad student or, again, as an entrepreneur. So
you're always definitely got to be thick-skinned.
You got it. You develop it eventually. Otherwise, you won't survive. But you're always going to be the most passionate person about your project. That's you have to start from that. That's what makes an entrepreneur, and you have to be cool with that.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody can be equally as passionate, but they likely won't be more than passionate than you.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to recognize that nobody cares as much about it as you do. Okay. And now you have to let go of it, or at least put it to the side. That's really hard.
Yeah.
That's really hard. And it was hard, but you also got to listen to the market and to the environment, for lack of a better word. If you can't force it at this particular time, and it's hard to force people to do anything, really, you won't be able to succeed because you can't do it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an actual learning from this experience, that you got to be very mindful of how hard and how long you bang your head against something, because otherwise you just increase your own personal grief factor exponentially. So that was harder, but you learned it, and I learned it. And the question that you then asked, like, is it more valuable to get something out in the market versus working on an idea? Both are equally valuable, and this is just something that you have to work out for yourself. What is it that drives you? And my reason for switching over from basic science and discovery-based science towards applied science and implementation science, if you will, on the engineering side, was to get something out in the market. So if that was true, again, an if-then statement, if that is true, that's why I switched, then I must act in the following way and I must get something to the market, which still is pretty much the same basic technology scaffold.
Yeah.
So that is true. At least I didn't have to throw that away.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have something that works in the market, and other people in the world and in Boston are thinking about using bacteriophages for cool things, and I'm around and I'm talking to them, so that's awesome.
Yeah.
I'm excited about that. So it is sometimes just a timing thing, and you have to be willing to look at it on a slightly longer timeline, which is incredibly hard usually for anyone, and especially anybody that is entrepreneurially minded, because we're generally impatient people.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what you gotta do.
Yeah.
Dr. Kors is taking on a new role as a member of Agene's board of directors, where he will help guide us as we grow in terms of the number of items we distribute, the types of items we distribute, and where we distribute them. Dr. Kors hopes that the expertise he's developed as a founder of Sample 6 will not only benefit Agene, but will also be put to use by many organizations in the biotech space. Listen more for some of the ways Dr. Kors hopes to provide advice to young biotech entrepreneurs.
Okay, cool. And so you've been talking about that there are other people looking at the phage and that type of thing, and that you get to go talk to them. So as part of your own goals, I've seen that you kind of want to help the startup community in general.
Yeah,
as kind of like the next phase in your own personal development.
Absolutely.
So what are you doing? What are your kind of current projects in order to do that?
Yeah, so several things. There's a small website that I've co-founded with actually a few of my friends that I met through the internets. Nowadays, that's how that works. It's called Biotech Start, which is not a super clever name because it's just to communicate more information to get more biotech companies started. But that's fundamentally what I want to do. I want to make sure that most everybody recognizes that it's not impossible. In fact, it's very probable and possible to start a biotech company, but you got to be mindful of a few things, and there's a few things that we want to communicate. I work a lot with the Boston startup community, which is not an amorphous thing. I don't want to make it sound like that, but it's rather the MIT bioengineering startup community, then the MIT biology startup community, then the Boston University bioengineering startup community, and the Boston University biology startup community, and so on. So it's many smaller pools that exist, and sometimes they overlap and talk to each other, and sometimes they do not. So what you got to do is you just got to talk and talk and talk and talk and talk to
people. Facilitate communication between a lot of people.
And essentially challenge people's assumptions and communicate a few of the learnings and failures that you have gone through. Mm-hmm. Not that people won't do it the same way, but just to provide data points. Very fundamentally, I think the opportunity exists for anybody that is doing startup right now, no matter how long they've been doing it or how successful they are or not, however successful they think they are, just communicate it back to the community. This is what I'm doing right now, and here's how that looks, and these are some of the learnings that I've had in order to generate more positive role models, I think, because anybody is a role model in this sense, showing anybody, undergraduate, graduate, even high schoolers, faculty, postdocs, industry veterans or industry participants or non-bioscientists that, yes, actually you can and you should be active in this space because we all need more innovation in biotech for clinical therapeutics and diagnostics and medical devices because that's what I'm passionate about. So I'm just going to go and talk about it all day long.
Sure, yeah. and so you're going to be part of the Agene board. Do you see that as kind of an extension of that? You're giving us your mentorship as well?
Absolutely. I'm exceptionally excited and honored and for the privilege of joining the Agene board. And I'm very thankful for Joanne and Melina and everybody else that has given me this opportunity. And it's part of it because Agene has been around for quite a while now, a decade. That's insanely long. It's twice as long as Sample 6, and I can't even imagine how long that feels to everybody who started it, like Melina and her husband and brother. And now it's going forward into its next decade. That's awesome. The global reach of Agene is daunting, and I want to make sure that it's more successful because the mission of Agene, as I feel it, is to equalize science and push science forward and accelerate science in order to bring more discovery and more learning and hopefully also more improvements for the human condition into the world. That's awesome.
Yeah.
And science is global. It's got to be global. Agene is global. It'll be more global. That's awesome.
Yeah. So you're really into enabling future generations of scientists.
Yeah, pretty much. We all know that the only thing I know is that everybody who comes after me will be more qualified and smarter than me. So that's pretty much true.
So.
That's definitely true.
Yeah.
And we need more people because the other thing is actually good ideas and innovation. There is no local limitation to that. There is no age limitation to that. There is no training limitation to that. So you never know where it's going to come from. And you just got to seed it all. So you got to shotgun it all over the place.
Yeah.
And get everybody playing around with it. The more, the merrier. And that's actually something that we've seen with coding and IT, specifically coding, because it's essentially free to code and the infrastructure is ubiquitous. And that's advanced the utilization of it enormously. And I think something similar like that with certain differences, of course, for biological systems can and should be true.
Excellent. There you have it. If you think you've got a great idea for a startup, don't be afraid to get out there and start talking about it. If you'd like more information on science careers and building your skill set, take a look at the career posts on our blog, blog.agene.org, or send us any questions to blog@agene.org. We'd love to hear from you. Thank you for listening to the Agene Podcast, a better way to share science.